Once you'd used your micro-blood sample to perform an immunoassay, there usually wasn't enough blood left for the completely different set of lab techniques a general chemistry or hematology assay required. Another was that, while microfluidic chips could handle very small volumes, no one had yet figured out how to avoid losing some of the sample during its transfer to the chip. Losing a little bit of the blood sample didn't matter much when it was large, but it became a big problem when it was tiny. To hear Elizabeth and Sunny tell it, Theranos had solved these and other difficulties, challenges that had bedeviled an entire branch of bioengineering research. Besides Theranos's supposed scientific accomplishments, what helped win James and Grossman over was its board of directors. In addition to Schultz and Mattis, it now included former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of Defense William Perry, former Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Sam Nunn, and former Navy Admiral Gary Ruffhead. These were men with sterling, larger-than-life reputations who gave Theranos a stamp of legitimacy. The common denominator between all of them was that, like Schultz, they were fellows at the Hoover Institution. After befriending Schultz, Elizabeth had methodically cultivated each one of them and offered them board seats in exchange for grants of stock. The presence of these former cabinet members, congressmen, and military officials on the board also lent credence to Elizabeth and Sonny's assertions that Theranos' devices were being used in the field by the U.S. military. James and Grossman thought that Theranos' fingerstick offerings in Walgreens and Safeway stores were likely to be a hit with consumers and to capture a large share of the U.S. blood testing market. A contract with the Department of Defense would add another big source of revenues. A spreadsheet with financial projections Sonny sent the hedge fund executives supported this notion. It forecast gross profits of $165 million on revenues of $261 million in 2014 and gross profits of $1.08 billion on revenues of $1.68 billion in 2015. Little did they know that Sonny had fabricated these numbers from whole cloth. Theranos hadn't had a real chief financial officer since Elizabeth had fired Henry Moseley in 2006. The closest thing the company had to one was a corporate controller named Denise Yam. 6 weeks after Sonny sent Partner Fund his projections, Yam sent very different ones to an advisory firm called Aranca for the purpose of pricing stock options for employees. Yam forecast a profit of $35 million in 2014 and of $100 million in 2015. $130 million and $980 million less, respectively, than what Sonny projected to Partner Fund. The gap in revenues was even bigger. She predicted revenues of $50 million in 2014 and of $134 million in 2015. $211 million and $1.55 billion less than the projections given to Partner Fund. As it would turn out, even Yam's numbers were wildly optimistic. James and Grossman, of course, had no way of knowing that Theranos' internal projections were 5 to 12-fold lower than the ones they were shown. It didn't occur to them that anything untoward could be going on at a company with such a prestigious board, not to mention the fact that this board had a special advisor named David Boyce, who attended all of its meetings. With one of the country's top lawyers keeping watch, what could possibly go wrong? On February 4, 2014, Partner Fund purchased 5,655,294 Theranos shares at a price of $17 a share, $2 a share more than the Lucas Venture Group had paid just 4 months earlier. The investment brought in another $96 million to Theranos' coffers and valued it at a stunning $9 billion. This meant that Elizabeth, who owned slightly more than half of the company, now had a net worth of almost $5 billion. Chapter 16. The Grandson. Standing in the middle of a crowd of his new colleagues in the cafeteria of the old Facebook building, Tyler Schultz listened to an emotional speech Elizabeth was giving. She was talking about her uncle's premature death from cancer and how an early warning from Theranos' blood tests could have prevented it. That was what she had spent the past 10 years tirelessly working toward, she said teary-eyed, her voice catching. A world in which no one would have to say goodbye to a loved one too soon. Tyler found the message deeply inspiring. He had started working at Theranos less than a week earlier, after graduating from Stanford the previous spring and taking the summer off to backpack around Europe. There had been a lot to absorb in the space of a few days, not least of which was the news Elizabeth had called this all-employee meeting to announce. The company was going live with its technology in Walgreens stores. Tyler had first met Elizabeth in late 2011 when he dropped by his grandfather George's house near the Stanford campus. He was a junior then, majoring in mechanical engineering. Elizabeth's vision of instant and painless tests run on drops of blood collected from fingertips had struck an immediate chord with him. After interning at Theranos that summer, he'd changed his major to biology and applied for a full-time position at the company. His first day at work had been filled with drama. A woman named Anjali, who headed the immunoassay team, had quit, and a group of employees had gathered in the parking lot to say goodbye to her. Word was that Anjali and Elizabeth had had a big falling out. Then, 3 days later, Tyler had been informed that the protein engineering group he'd originally been assigned to was being disbanded, and everyone was being moved to the undermanned immunoassay team to help out. It was all a bit chaotic and confusing, but Elizabeth's stirring speech made his budding concerns melt away. He left the meeting energized and motivated to work really hard. A month into the job, Tyler met a new hire named Erica Chung. Like Tyler, Erica was a newly minted college grad who'd majored in biology, but that was about all they had in common. With his dirty blonde hair and famous grandfather, Tyler was a product of the establishment, while Erica came from a middle-class, mixed-race family. Her father had emigrated to the United States from Hong Kong and worked his way up from package handler to engineering manager at UPS. She'd spent large stretches of her youth homeschooled. Despite their very different backgrounds, Tyler and Erica became fast friends. Their job on the immunoassay team was to help run experiments to verify the accuracy of blood tests on Theranos' Edison devices before they were deployed in the lab for use on patients. This verification process was known as assay validation. The blood samples used for these experiments came from employees and sometimes from employees' friends and family members. To encourage employees to give blood, Theranos paid them $10 per tube. That meant you could make as much as $50 in one sitting. Tyler and Erica competed to see who could get to $600 first, the threshold beyond which the company had to report the payments as compensation to the IRS. One weekend, Theranos was looking for more volunteers, so Tyler recruited his four housemates to come give blood with him. They used their combined loot, $250, to buy beer and burgers and threw a party that evening at the ramshackle house they rented a few blocks away. The first thing that dampened Tyler's enthusiasm for working at Theranos was seeing the inside of an Edison. During his internship the previous summer, he hadn't been allowed near one, so his anticipation was high when a Chinese scientist named Ran Hu showed him one of the machines with its black and white case removed. Standing next to Tyler was Aruna Ayer, his supervisor. Aruna was just as curious as he was. In her previous role as head of the protein engineering group, she had never seen an Edison either. As Ran did a quick demonstration, Tyler and Aruna weren't sure what to think. The device seemed to consist of nothing more than a pipette fastened to a robotic arm that moved back and forth on a gantry. Both had envisioned some sort of sophisticated microfluidic system, but this seemed like something a middle schooler could build in his garage. Trying to keep an open mind, Aruna asked, "Ran, do you think this is cool?" In a tone that implied she did not, Ran replied, "I'll let you decide for yourself." When its case was back on, the Edison did sport a touchscreen software interface, but even that was a letdown. You had to pound on the screen's icons to get it to work. Tyler and some other members of the group joked that Steve Jobs would have rolled over in his grave if he had seen one of them. Tyler felt a wave of disappointment wash over him, but beat it back by telling himself that the 4S, the next-generation device he had heard was in the works, was probably much more intricate. Soon, there were other things that began to trouble Tyler. One type of experiment he and Erica were tasked with doing involved retesting blood samples on the Edisons over and over to measure how much their results varied. The data collected were used to calculate each Edison blood test's coefficient of variation, or CV. A test is generally considered precise if its CV is less than 10%. To Tyler's dismay, data runs that didn't achieve low enough CVs were simply discarded, and the experiments repeated until the desired number was reached. It was as if you flipped a coin enough times to get 10 heads in a row and then declared that the coin always returned heads. Even within the good data runs, Tyler and Erica noticed that some values were deemed outliers and deleted. When Erica asked the group's more senior scientists how they defined an outlier, no one could give her a straight answer. Erica and Tyler might be young and inexperienced, but they both knew that cherry-picking data wasn't good science. Nor were they the only ones who had concerns about these practices. Aruna, whom Tyler liked and respected, also disapproved of them, and so did Michael Humbert, a jovial German scientist Tyler had befriended. One of the validation experiments Tyler helped with involved a test to detect syphilis. Some tests measure the concentration of a substance in the blood, such as cholesterol, to determine whether it is too high. Others, like the syphilis test, provide a yes or no answer about whether a patient has a particular disease or not. The accuracy of those tests is gauged by their sensitivity, the measure of how often they correctly label someone with the disease as positive. Over a period of several days, Tyler and several colleagues tested 247 blood samples on Edisons, 66 of which were known to be positive for the disease. During the first run, the devices correctly detected only 65% of the positive samples. During the second run, they correctly detected 80% of them. Yet, in its validation report, Theranos stated that its syphilis test had a sensitivity of 95%. Erica and Tyler thought Theranos was also being misleading about the accuracy of other Edison tests, such as a test to measure vitamin D. When a blood sample would be tested on an analyzer made by the Italian company Diasorin, it might show a vitamin D concentration of 20 nanograms per milliliter, which was considered adequate for a healthy patient. But when Erica tested the same sample on the Edison, the result would be 10 or 12 nanograms per milliliter, a value that signified a vitamin D deficiency. The Edison's vitamin D test was nonetheless cleared for use in the clinical lab on live patient samples, as were two Edison thyroid hormone tests and a test to measure PSA, the prostate cancer marker. In November 2013, Erica was moved from the immunoassay group to the clinical lab and assigned to Normandy, the room downstairs with the lab's Edison machines. During the Thanksgiving holiday, a patient order came in from the Walgreens store in Palo Alto for a vitamin D test. As she had been trained to do, Erica ran a quality control check on the Edison devices before testing the patient sample. Quality control checks are a basic safeguard against inaccurate results and are at the heart of the way laboratories operate. They involve testing a sample of preserved blood plasma that has an already known concentration of an analyte and seeing if the lab's test for that analyte matches the known value. If the result obtained is 2 standard deviations higher or lower than the known value, the quality control check is usually deemed to have failed. The first quality control check Erica ran failed, so she ran a second one. That one failed too. Erica was unsure what to do. The lab's higher-ups were on vacation, so she emailed an emergency helpline the company had set up. Sam Anakol, Suraj Saxena, and Daniel Young responded to her email with various suggestions, but nothing they proposed worked. After a while, an employee named Uyen Do from the research and development side came down and took a look at the quality control readings. Under the protocol Sunny and Daniel had established, the way Theranos generated a result from the Edisons was unorthodox, to say the least. First, the little fingerstick samples were diluted with the TCAN liquid handler and split into 3 parts. Then the 3 diluted parts were tested on 3 different Edisons. Each device had 2 pipette tips that dropped down into the diluted blood, generating 2 values. So together, the 3 devices produced 6 values. The final result was obtained by taking the median of those 6 values. Following this protocol, Erica had tested 2 quality control samples across 3 devices, generating 6 values during each run for a total of 12 values. Without bothering to explain her rationale to Erica, Doe deleted 2 of those 12 values, declaring them outliers. She then went ahead and tested the patient's sample and sent out a result. This wasn't how you were supposed to handle repeat quality control failures. Normally, 2 such failures in a row would have been cause to take the devices offline and recalibrate them. Moreover, Doe wasn't even authorized to be in the clinical lab. Unlike Erica, she didn't have a CLS license and had no standing to process patient samples. The episode left Erica shaken. Less than a week later, Alan Beam was chatting nervously in Jurassic Park, the upstairs lab, with a female inspector from the Laboratory Field Services Division of the California Department of Public Health. The Theranos' lab's CLIA certificate was nearly 2 years old and up for renewal, which required the lab to pass an inspection. The Federal Medicare Agency outsourced these types of routine inspections to state inspectors. Sunny had let it be known that no employee was to enter or exit Normandy during the inspection. The stairs that led to the downstairs room were hidden behind a door that could only be opened with a key card. Alan and other members of the lab interpreted the directive as a clear signal that Sunny didn't want the inspector to inquire about what was behind the door. The inspector spent several hours in the upstairs part of the lab and found some relatively minor problems that Alan pledged to correct promptly. Then she was gone, unaware that she had missed the part of the lab that contained the company's proprietary devices. Alan didn't know whether to be relieved or angry. Had he just helped hoodwink a regulator? Why was he being put in this position? In the days following the inspection, Sunny ordered a switch from regular venous draws to fingerstick draws for dozens of the blood tests Theranos was offering in Walgreens stores, not just the 4 performed on the Edisons. That meant that the system Daniel Young and Sam Gong had jury-rigged with the Siemens Advias would now be used on regular patients. It didn't take long for problems to surface. Elizabeth and Sunny had decided to make Phoenix their main launch market, drawn by Arizona's pro-business reputation and its large number of uninsured patients, who they believed would be especially receptive to the low prices Theranos offered. So, in addition to its 1 Palo Alto location, the company had just opened 2 wellness centers in Walgreens stores in the Phoenix area, with plans for several dozen more. Elizabeth planned to open a 2nd lab in Phoenix, but for now the fingerstick samples collected in the Arizona stores were being FedExed back to Palo Alto for testing. The arrangement was far from ideal. The nanotainers were shipped in coolers, but the coolers heated up when they sat baking in the sun for hours on the airport tarmac. This caused the blood in the little tubes to clot. Just as had been the case before the launch when they were still testing employee samples, Allen was also encountering issues with potassium results. The blood in the nanotainers was often pink, a telltale sign of hemolysis, and the potassium results the diluted samples were producing were consistently too high. Some were so high that the only way they could have been accurate was if the patients were dead. The problem got so bad that Allen implemented a rule that no potassium result above a certain threshold could be released to a patient. He pleaded with Elizabeth to pull the potassium test from the Theranos menu. Instead, she sent Daniel Young to try to fix the assay. In early 2014, Tyler Schultz was moved from the immunoassay group to the production team, which operated downstairs in Normandy. This put him back near Erica and other colleagues from the clinical lab who were processing patient samples on the Edisons and the modified Siemens Advias. There were no physical barriers between the two groups, so Tyler could hear the chatter among the lab associates. Tyler learned from Erica and others that the Edisons were frequently flunking quality control checks, and that Sonny was pressuring lab personnel to ignore the failures and to test patient samples on the devices anyway. As he debated what to do, he got a call from his grandfather. George said he was throwing Elizabeth a 30th birthday party, and he wanted his grandson to come and play a tune for her. Tyler had been playing the guitar since high school and liked to compose his own songs. During his travels the previous summer, he'd played in pubs and on street corners around Ireland. Tyler tried to get out of it by invoking work. His shift on the production team was from 3 p.m. to 1 a.m., overlapping with the evening party. But George insisted. He'd already made a seating chart and placed his grandson between Channing Robertson and Elizabeth at the dinner table. And he was sure Elizabeth wouldn't mind if Tyler missed work to celebrate her birthday. She wanted him there, he said. A few days later, Tyler found himself mingling with other guests in the living room of George's home, a big, light blue shingled house perched on a hill next to the Stanford campus. George's second wife, Charlotte, was playing host to the festivities. Elizabeth's parents had flown in for the occasion, and her younger brother, Christian, was there too. So were Channing Robertson and Theranos board member Bill Perry, who had served as Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration. At his grandfather's urging, Tyler played the song he'd hastily composed. He tried not to cringe as he sang its cheesy lyrics, which borrowed from Theranos's "One Tiny Drop Changes Everything" slogan. To his horror, he had to play it again a little while later because Henry Kissinger arrived late, and everybody thought that he too should hear it. When Tyler was finished, Kissinger, who like George Schultz was in his early 90s, recited a limerick he'd written for the birthday girl. The scene had a surreal quality to it. They were all sitting in a circle in the Schultz's living room, and Elizabeth was in the middle, reveling in the attention. It was as though she were the queen, and they were her court, kissing her ring. As awkward as the evening was, it made Tyler feel like he was on friendly enough terms with Elizabeth to speak to her candidly about his concerns. Shortly after the party, he sent her an email asking if they could meet. Elizabeth invited him to her office. The meeting was brief, but he had time to raise a few of the issues that bothered him. One of them was the representations Theranos made about the precision of its blood tests. The company claimed that its tests had coefficients of variation of less than 10%, but the CVs in many of its validation reports were much higher, he told her. Elizabeth acted surprised and said she didn't think Theranos had made such a claim. She suggested they look at its website together and called it up on her big iMac. A part of the site titled "Our Technology" did prominently advertise a coefficient of variation of less than 10%, with a catchy green and white circular logo. But Elizabeth noted that the smaller print above it specified that the claim only covered Theranos' vitamin D test. Tyler conceded her point and made a mental note to check the vitamin D validation data. He then brought up the fact that his own CV calculations often didn't match those he found in the validation reports. By his count, the percentages in the reports were lower than they should be. In other words, Theranos was exaggerating the precision of its blood tests. "That doesn't sound right," Elizabeth said. She suggested he go speak with Daniel Young. Daniel would be able to walk him through how Theranos performed its data analyses and clear up any confusion. Over the following weeks, Tyler met with Daniel Young twice. Talking to Daniel could be frustrating. He had a long forehead, accentuated by a receding hairline, that suggested a big, powerful brain. But it was impossible to know what went on inside that brain. His eyes, behind their wire-rim glasses, never betrayed any emotion. During their first meeting, Daniel calmly explained why Tyler's CV calculations were wrong. Tyler was taking into account the 6 values, or replicates, generated during each Edison test, instead of just the median of those 6 values. The final result Theranos reported to a patient was the median, so only that number was relevant to CV calculations, he said. Daniel may have technically been correct, but Tyler had put his finger on a central weakness of the Edison device. Its pipette tips were terribly imprecise. Generating 6 measurements during each test and then selecting the median was a way to correct for that imprecision. If the tips had been reliable in the first place, there would have been no need for such contortions. The conversation shifted to the syphilis test and what Tyler felt was its overstated sensitivity. Again, Daniel had a ready explanation. Some of the Edison's syphilis results had fallen into an equivocal zone. Results in that zone hadn't been included in the sensitivity calculation. Tyler remained dubious. There didn't seem to be any predefined criteria for this so-called equivocal zone. It could be widened at will until the sensitivity reached whatever number the company wanted. In the case of the syphilis test, it was so wide that more samples had been deemed equivocal than the Edisons had correctly identified as positive. Tyler asked Daniel if he thought Theranos' syphilis test was truly the most accurate syphilis test on the market, as the company claimed. Daniel replied that Theranos had never claimed to have the most accurate tests. After Tyler got back to his desk, he Googled the 2 recent articles that had been published in the press about Theranos and emailed them to Daniel. One of them was Elizabeth's Wall Street Journal interview, which stated that Theranos' tests were more accurate than the conventional methods, and called that improved accuracy a scientific advance. When they met again a few days later, Daniel allowed that the statements in the journal piece were too sweeping, but argued that they had been made by the writer, not by Elizabeth herself. Tyler found this argument a little too convenient. Surely the writer hadn't made up these claims on his own. He must have heard them from Elizabeth. A faint smile briefly crossed Daniel's lips. "Well, sometimes Elizabeth exaggerates in an interview setting," he said. There was something else that was bothering Tyler, something he'd just gotten wind of from Erica, and he decided to bring that up too. All clinical laboratories must submit 3 times a year to something called proficiency testing, an exercise designed to ferret out labs whose testing isn't accurate. Accredited bodies like the College of American Pathologists send laboratories samples of preserved blood plasma and ask them to test for various analytes. During its first 2 years of operation, the Theranos lab had always tested proficiency testing samples on commercial analyzers. But since it was now using the Edisons for some patient tests, Alan Beam and his new lab co-director had been curious to see how the devices fared in the exercise. Beam and the new co-director, Mark Pandori, had ordered Erica and other lab associates to split the proficiency testing samples and run one part on the Edison's and the other part on the lab's Siemens and Diasorin analyzers for comparison. The Edison results had differed markedly from the Siemens and Diasorin ones, especially for vitamin D. When Sonny had learned of their little experiment, he'd hit the roof. Not only had he put an immediate end to it, he had made them report only the Siemens and Diasorin results. There was a lot of chatter in the lab that the Edison results should have been the ones reported. Tyler had looked up the CLIA regulations, and they seemed to bear that out. They stated that proficiency testing samples must be tested and analyzed in the same manner as patient specimens using the laboratory's routine methods. Theranos tested patient samples for vitamin D, PSA, and the two thyroid hormones on the Edison's, so it followed that the proficiency testing results for those four analytes should have come from the Edison's. Tyler told Daniel he didn't see how what Theranos had done could be legal. Daniel's response followed a torturous logic. He said a laboratory's proficiency testing results were assessed by comparing them to its peers' results, which wasn't possible in Theranos' case, because its technology was unique and had no peer group. As a result, the only way to do an apples-to-apples comparison was by using the same conventional methods as other laboratories. Besides, proficiency testing rules were extremely complicated, he argued. Tyler could rest assured that no laws had been broken. Tyler didn't buy it. At 9:16 a.m. on Monday, March 31st, 2014, the email Tyler had been waiting for all weekend landed in his Yahoo inbox, or rather, in the inbox of Colin Ramirez, an alias he had made up to remain anonymous. The email was from Stephanie Schulman, director of the Clinical Laboratory Evaluation Program at the New York State Department of Health. She was responding to a query Tyler had submitted the previous Friday under the cover of his new fictional identity. Tyler had reached out to the New York Health Department because it ran one of the proficiency testing programs Theranos had participated in. He still suspected that the way the company conducted proficiency testing was improper, and he wanted an expert opinion. After exchanging a few emails with Schulman, Tyler had his answer. In response to a description he gave her of Theranos' practices, she wrote back that they amounted to a form of PT cheating and were in violation of the state and federal requirements. Schulman gave Tyler two options. He could give her the name of the offending laboratory, or he could file an anonymous complaint with New York State's Laboratory Investigative Unit. He chose to do the latter. Armed with the knowledge that he was correct about his proficiency testing suspicions, Tyler went to see his grandfather. They sat down together in the dining room of George's big house, and Tyler tried to explain to the former Secretary of State the concepts of precision, sensitivity, quality control, and proficiency testing, and to show him why he thought Theranos' approach to each was lacking. He also revealed that Theranos was using its proprietary device for only a handful of the more than 200 blood tests it advertised on its website, and that before samples could even be processed on the device, they had to be diluted with a third-party machine 6 feet long and 2.5 feet wide that cost tens of thousands of dollars. George took it all in quizzically. Tyler could tell he wasn't getting through to him, but he needed him to know as both his grandfather and a member of the company's board of directors that he could no longer be a party to what was going on. He told him he planned to quit. George asked him to hold off and to give Elizabeth another chance to address everything. Tyler agreed to do so and tried to set up another meeting with Elizabeth, but her rising public profile made her very busy. She asked him to send her an email with his concerns instead. So he went ahead and typed up a long note that summarized his conversations with Daniel Young and explained why he'd found most of Daniel's answers unconvincing. He He even included charts and validation data to illustrate his various points. He closed with, "I am sorry if this email sounds attacking in any way. I do not intend it to be. I just feel a responsibility to you to tell you what I see so we can work towards solutions. I am invested in this company's long-term vision and am worried that some of our current practices will prevent us from reaching our bigger goals." Tyler didn't hear anything back for several days. When the response finally arrived, it didn't come from Elizabeth. It came from Sonny, and it was withering. In a point-by-point rebuttal that was longer than Tyler's original email, Sonny belittled everything from his grasp of statistics to his knowledge of laboratory science. The overall message was that Tyler was too junior and green to understand what he was talking about. Sonny's tone throughout was dripping with venom, but he reserved his sharpest words for the questions Tyler had raised about proficiency testing. "That reckless comment and accusation about the integrity of our company, its leadership, and its core team members based on absolute ignorance is so insulting to me that had any other person made these statements, we would have held them accountable in the strongest way. The only reason I have taken so much time away from work to address this personally is because you are Mr. Schultz's grandson. I have now spent an extraordinary amount of time postponing critical business matters to investigate your assertions. The only email on this topic I want to see from you going forward is an apology that I'll pass on to other people, including Daniel here." Tyler decided it was time to resign. He replied to Sonny with a one-sentence email giving his 2 weeks' notice and offering to leave earlier if he wished him to. A few hours later, Mona, the head of HR, summoned him to her office and informed him that the company had decided he should leave that day. She made him sign some new non-disclosure forms and told him security would escort him out of the building. But no one from security was available to come get him, so Tyler saw himself out. He hadn't even made it to his car when his cell phone rang. It was his mother, and she sounded frantic. "Stop whatever you're about to do," she implored. Tyler told her it was too late. He had already resigned and signed his exit papers. "That's not what I mean. I just got off the phone with your grandfather. He said Elizabeth called him and told him that if you insist on carrying out your vendetta against her, you will lose." Tyler was dumbfounded. Elizabeth was threatening him through his family, using his grandfather to deliver the message. He felt a surge of anger. After hanging up with his mother, he headed over to the Hoover Institution. George Schultz's secretary showed him to his grandfather's corner office on the second floor of the Herbert Hoover Memorial Building. A lifetime's worth of books lined the shelves. Tyler was still unnerved by Elizabeth's threat, but calmly explained to George what had happened. He showed him his email to Elizabeth and Sonny's blistering reply. George asked his secretary to make photocopies of them and to put them in his office safe. Tyler thought he might be getting through this time, but he wasn't sure. The old man was hard to read. His years as a senior member of the president's cabinet, facing down threats like the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War, had made him a cipher. He absorbed information but rarely volunteered any. They agreed to meet again for dinner that evening at his grandfather's house. As they parted, George told Tyler, "They're trying to convince me that you're stupid. They can't convince me that you're stupid. They can, however, convince me that you're wrong, and in this case, I do believe that you're wrong." Erica knew that Tyler had quit and asked herself if she should do the same. Things in the lab had gotten out of control. In addition to the 4 original Edison tests, the assay validation team had cleared a hepatitis C test on the Edisons for clinical use. Giving patients inaccurate vitamin D results was one thing, but the stakes got a lot higher when you were testing for infectious diseases. A patient order for a hepatitis C test had come in, and Erica had refused to run the sample on the Edisons. When Mark Pandori had asked her to come talk to him about it, she'd broken down in tears in his office. Erica and Mark had a good relationship, and Erica trusted him. Ever since he'd arrived a few months earlier, Mark had tried to do the right thing, including with proficiency testing. Erica told Mark the reagents for the hepatitis C test were expired, the Edisons hadn't been recalibrated in a while, and she simply didn't trust the devices. So they had devised a plan to run patient samples on commercially available hepatitis kits called OraQuick HCV. That had worked for a while, but then the lab had run out of them. When they'd tried to place an order for a new batch, Sonny had lost his temper and threatened to block it. Then, that very afternoon, at about the same time Tyler had gotten his mother's frantic call, Sonny had summoned her to his office. He had gone through Tyler's emails and figured out that Erica was the one who had sent him the proficiency testing results. Their conversation had started out cordially enough, but Sonny had berated her when she'd brought up the quality control failures in the lab. His parting words had been, "You need to tell me if you want to work here or not." When her shift was over, Erica went to meet up with Tyler. He suggested she accompany him to his grandfather's house for dinner. If George saw that his grandson wasn't the only employee with misgivings about the way Theranos operated, he might come around. Erica agreed that it was worth a try. When they got there, however, it quickly became apparent to Tyler that his grandfather's allegiance to Theranos had strengthened in the intervening hours. As the Schultz's household staff waited on them, Tyler and Erica ran through the list of their concerns, but only George's wife, Charlotte, seemed receptive to what they were saying. She kept asking them in a shocked tone of voice to repeat various parts of their story. George, on the other hand, was unmoved. Tyler had noticed how much he doted on Elizabeth. His relationship with her seemed closer than their own. Tyler also knew that his grandfather was passionate about science. Scientific progress would make the world a better place and save it from such perils as pandemics and climate change, he often told his grandson. This passion seemed to make him unable to let go of the promise of Theranos. George said a top surgeon in New York had told him the company was going to revolutionize the field of surgery, and this was someone his good friend Henry Kissinger considered to be the smartest man alive. And according to Elizabeth, Theranos' devices were already being used in medevac helicopters and hospital operating rooms, so they must be working. Tyler and Erica tried to tell him that couldn't possibly be true, given that the devices were barely working within the walls of Theranos. But it was clear they weren't making any headway. George urged them to put the company behind them and to move on with their lives. They both had bright futures ahead, he told them. They left the dinner frustrated, with little choice but to follow his advice. The next morning, Erica quit too. She wrote up a short resignation letter and gave it to Mark Pandori to pass on to Elizabeth and Sonny. It said she disagreed with running patient samples on the Edisons and that she didn't think she and the company shared the same standards in patient care and quality. After taking a look at it, Mark gave it back to her and recommended she leave quietly without making waves. Erica thought about it for a moment and decided he was probably right. She folded the letter back up and put it in her backpack. But while processing Erica's resignation in her office a few minutes later, Mona asked if she had taken anything from the company. To show she hadn't, Erica opened her backpack and showed her its contents. Mona spotted the letter inside and confiscated it. She made Erica sign a new confidentiality agreement and warned her against writing anything about Theranos on Facebook, LinkedIn, or any other forum. "We have ways of tracking that," she said. "We'll see it if you post anything anywhere." Chapter 17. Fame. Richard and Joe Fuse sat warily across from David Boyce and one of his partners at a table in the lobby lounge of San Jose's Fairmont Hotel. It was a Sunday evening in the middle of March, and the usually bustling lounge's two grand pianos were quiet, allowing the four men to speak without raising their voices. Boyce, looking relaxed and dapper in a navy blazer and his signature black sneakers, had called the meeting to discuss settling the litigation that had pitted the Fuses against Theranos for the past 2.5 years. Initially determined to fight the lawsuit to the bitter end, Richard and Joe were tired and battered. The trial had started a few days earlier at the federal courthouse down the street, and the extent to which they were outgunned had fully dawned on them. Unhappy with their lawyers and their mounting legal costs, they had gone pro se several months earlier. What had seemed then like a reasonable decision now looked foolish. Joe, a patent attorney who had never tried a case, was no match for the country's best litigator and his army of associates. The death of Ian Gibbons had also been a big setback. It briefly looked like they might be able to make up for it by calling his widow, Rochelle, as a witness. After Richard managed to make contact with her, Rochelle told him that Elizabeth had tried to bully Ian into not testifying, and that Ian thought she was dishonest. But the judge overseeing the case had denied the Fuses' late motion to call Rochelle to the stand. More damaging, though, had been Richard Fuse's own courtroom testimony 2 days earlier. Boyce had caught him in a series of pointless lies that, while they did nothing to prove Theranos' theft allegations, had undermined his credibility. One of them was Fuse's contention that he still practiced medicine and treated patients, a claim his own wife had refuted in her deposition. For no discernible reason other than pride, Fuse had refused to back away from it, even after Boyce confronted him with her testimony. In his rambling opening argument, Fuse had also stated that his patent had nothing to do with Theranos, which was absurd on its face, given that his patent application mentioned the company by name and quoted from its website. Joe had watched his father's disastrous performance on the stand with growing alarm. His dad had once been an amazing pitchman in business settings because he was a terrific schmoozer and improviser, but that off-the-cuff, loose-with-the-facts approach didn't work when you were being questioned under oath by a legal ace ready to pounce on any inconsistency. It didn't help that, at 74 years old, Richard's memory was beginning to slip. Joe feared his brother John's upcoming testimony might turn into another liability. Boyce knew John had a bad temper and would no doubt find ways to press his buttons in front of the jury. He had already brought up the fact that John had threatened Elizabeth during his deposition. When he added it all up in his mind, Joe knew they were in trouble. And with a courtroom defeat looking like a very real possibility, he was haunted by a terrifying thought. What if they not only lost, but the judge made them cover Theranos' legal expenses? He shivered to think how much money their opponent was spending on the case. He worried it might be enough to bankrupt him and his father both. They had already spent more than $2 million on their defense. Boyce had come to their powwow with Mike Underhill, one of the Boyce-Schiller attorneys running point on the litigation. Underhill, a very tall and gangly man, broke the ice by asking Richard Fuse if he had really grown up on a farm. The answer was yes. That led to Fuse and Boyce discussing raising cattle, which Boyce had some experience with from the ranch he owned in Napa Valley. When the conversation eventually turned to the matter at hand, Underhill said both sides would be better off settling the case. If, however, the Fuses remained intent on pressing forward with the trial, they should know that matters would be revealed that would destroy John Fuse. Underhill didn't specify what, nor did he say this menacingly. He made it sound as though he liked John, and it would pain him to see him get hurt. There was some irony to Underhill's threat to air dirty laundry about John. The two of them had once been colleagues at McDermott, Will, and Emery, and had shared a secretary. Underhill had left McDermott Not long after, John had made a sexual harassment complaint against him on the secretary's behalf to the firm's human resources department. Underhill denies any untoward behavior and says his departure from McDermott to join Boyce Schiller was already in motion. The prospect of new damaging information coming out about his brother added yet another worry to Joe's long list, but the truth was that he and his father had come to the meeting ready to settle. It didn't take long for an agreement to take shape. The Fuses would withdraw their patent in exchange for Theranos withdrawing its suit. No money would change hands. Each party would remain responsible for its legal costs. It amounted to a complete capitulation on the Fuses' part. Elizabeth had won. Boyce insisted they draft the agreement right then and there. He wrote the terms down on a piece of paper and passed it to Joe, who made a few modifications. Underhill then took it upstairs to have it typed up. As they waited for Underhill to return, Richard Fuse complained once more that Elizabeth's theft accusation was false. Playing the part of the magnanimous victor, Boyce allowed that that might be the case, but he had a client to answer to. Fuse asked Boyce if he could do something for John. His son's reputation had been unjustly sullied, he said. Underhill had previously raised with Joe the notion that Boyce Schiller could refer patent work to John if he signed a release promising not to sue Elizabeth or the firm. Boyce repeated that offer. He would need to wait 6 months for things to quiet down, but then he could start sending work John's way. He suggested they get John on the phone to talk it over. Fuse dialed John's number in Washington and passed his cell phone to Boyce. As it turned out, John was in no mood to make nice. He had been looking forward to testifying in court. He saw it as his chance to clear his name. Now this settlement would prevent him from doing that. He angrily told Boyce there was no way he would ever sign a release unless Theranos issued a public statement exonerating him. Richard and Joe could see the conversation wasn't going well. Boyce was holding the phone several inches from his ear and wincing as John shouted on the other end of the line. After a few minutes, Boyce passed the phone back to Fuse. Their little side deal was dead. But the main agreement stood. When Underhill came back with the printed settlement, Richard and Joe read it and signed it. Afterward, Richard Fuse looked utterly defeated. The proud and pugnacious former CIA agent broke down and sobbed. The next morning, Fuse jotted down a note on a paper pad from the hotel and, when he got to the courthouse, asked Boyce to pass it on to Elizabeth. It read, "Dear Elizabeth, this matter is resolved now. I wish great success for you and health and happiness for your parents. We all can be wrong. Life is like that. Please know that in fact none of the 612 patent came from any of your provisionals. It derived from my brain only. Best wishes, Richard Fuse." Back in Washington, the settlement didn't sit well with John Fuse. He was mad at everyone, including his father and brother, for agreeing to a deal that gave Theranos everything it wanted before he'd had a chance to tell his side of the story in court. In his pique, John emailed a young reporter named Julia Love, who had been covering the case for American Lawyer Media, and told her about the quid pro quo Boyce had sought the night before, making it sound like an attempt to bribe him. He also vowed to sue Boyce and to add his father and brother to the suit as defendants. He then forwarded the email to Underhill and to Richard and Joe, letting them know that anything they sent his way would be forwarded to the media. Underhill responded angrily a few hours later, leaving the reporter off his reply but copying his boss. He denied any attempt to bribe John and warned him that Boyce Schiller would hold him responsible if he continued to make such claims. In case the message wasn't clear, Boyce himself chimed in from his iPad a few minutes later. "Those who the gods would destroy, they first make mad." Julia Love's article about the settlement in Litigation Daily, ALM's newsletter, caught the eye of Roger Parloff, Fortune magazine's legal correspondent. Parloff, who had once practiced law as a white-collar criminal defense attorney in Manhattan before becoming a journalist, was always on the lookout for legal sagas to write about. This particular case struck him as strange, and, in his experience, strange cases usually made for good yarns. Why had Boyce, arguably the country's most famous lawyer, with his pick of high-profile cases to choose from, handled this obscure patent trial himself, instead of delegating it to a more junior associate? Then there was the fact that John Fuse, an attorney who was the son of one of the defendants and brother of the other, was publicly threatening to sue both the plaintiff and Boyce for making false accusations. From his office in the Time and Life building in Midtown Manhattan, Parloff picked up the phone and called Don Schneider, Boyce's longtime public relations representative. Parloff's call was perfect timing from Schneider's perspective. She had just talked to an ebullient Boyce about the case and decided she should try to get him some press about it. She offered to come brief the Fortune writer in person. The Boyce-Schiller offices at 51st Street and Lexington Avenue were just four avenue blocks away. As she walked across Midtown, it occurred to Schneider that Boyce's victory in the Fuse case was a good story, but the far better story was Theranos and its brilliant young founder. She had never met Elizabeth, but she'd been hearing Boyce rave about her for several years. This was an opportunity to get David's protege national attention, just as her company prepared to expand across the country. By the time she got to the Fortune offices on Avenue of the Americas, Schneider had changed her pitch. Parloff listened, intrigued. He hadn't seen the Wall Street Journal article from the previous fall, so he had never heard of Theranos, but, according to Schneider, that was precisely the point. It was like writing about Apple or Google in their early days before they became Silicon Valley icons and entered the collective consciousness. "Roger, this is the greatest company you've never heard of," she said. "Think of it as an old-school Fortune cover." A few weeks later, Parloff flew out to Palo Alto to meet Elizabeth. Over the course of several days, he interviewed her for a combined 7 hours. After getting over his initial shock at her deep voice, he found her smart and engaging. When they broached topics other than blood testing, she was unassuming, almost naive. But when their conversations shifted to Theranos, she became steely and intense. She was also very controlling with information. She dangled a scoop. Theranos had raised more than $400 million from investors at a valuation of $9 billion, making it one of the most valuable startups in Silicon Valley. And she showed Parloff the mini-lab, though she didn't refer to it by any name. But she wouldn't let the magazine take photos of it, and she didn't want Parloff to use the words device or machine to describe it. She preferred analyzer. Leaving those quirks aside, what Elizabeth told Parloff she'd achieved seemed genuinely innovative and impressive. As she and Sonny had stated to Partner Fund, she told him the Theranos analyzer could perform as many as 70 different blood tests from one tiny fingerstick draw, and she led him to believe that the more than 200 tests on its menu were all fingerstick tests done with proprietary technology. Since he didn't have the expertise to vet her scientific claims, Parloff interviewed the prominent members of her board of directors and effectively relied on them as character witnesses. He talked to Schultz, Perry, Kissinger, Nunn, Mattis, and to two new directors, Richard Kovacevich, the former CEO of the giant bank Wells Fargo, and former Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. Before going into politics, Frist had been a heart and lung transplant surgeon. All of them vouched for Elizabeth emphatically. Schultz and Mattis were particularly effusive. "Everywhere you look with this young lady, there's a purity of motivation," Schultz told him. "I mean, she really is trying to make the world better, and this is her way of doing it." Mattis went out of his way to praise her integrity. She has probably one of the most mature and well-honed sense of ethics